today, guys. Today we have Osama Dorius, the lead game designer at Warner Brothers Games. In the past, he's also worked at such companies as Ubisoft, Gameloft, and Minority Media, and he's a professor at Dawson College, as well as a lifelong advocate for marginalized voices, which is something that's really important to me. Something else that I thought was really cool and fun is that on his LinkedIn, he has an award which says, Ray of Sunshine, which is honestly so true, because just from this one conversation, I can tell you that he is one of the nicest people that you will ever meet. We're going to talk about different management styles, which ones are the most effective, as well as lifelong learning, and standing up for yourself and your beliefs in the workplace, when to do it, how to do it, and other really useful pieces of advice. So I hope that you find this episode to be as informative as I did, and without further ado, enjoy! Hi guys, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Hey, Ari, good to see you as always. Nice to see you again, Osama.
Yeah, it's really good to see you. Thank you for having me on.
No, I was super excited when you actually accepted this opportunity to come on the podcast. You know, I know between the skills you have not only professionally, but as a teacher and speaking at GDC, that I'm just really excited to come on and give you an opportunity to kind of like talk about what you've done, how you create amazing experiences. So
I'm super happy to be here to catch up, find out what you're up to as well.
Oh, I have lots of things I'm up to.
So, Osama, you are a lead game designer, is that right?
That's right. On Gotham Knights at WB Games.
That's really cool. And what kind of other projects have you worked on throughout your career?
So, actually, I've been very fortunate. I've worked on a big variety of projects. I started off in the industry in mobile. I worked at a company called Gameloft. And I worked on like 20 plus games. And when I say mobile, I mean before smartphones, like flip phones, the old phones, the ones used to be able to throw out the window and they'll survive. Then after that, I went to a company called GEE where I worked on airplane games. And by that, I don't mean flight simulators. I mean in-flight entertainment, the games you play in airplanes when you're flying.
Like on the back of the chair?
That's right. The annoying ones when you're trying to sleep and someone's poking at the back of your seat. Yeah, that's my fault. Then after that, I went to Ubisoft. That was my first taste of AAA. I worked on a game called For Honor. So it's kind of like a combat game, but multiplayer. I mean, more than two players is what I meant to say. Mm-hmm. And after that was the first time I went to indie. I worked at a company called Minority Media. They were famous for a game called Papueyo. And actually, that was the reason I joined the studio. That was a very meaningful game. And I wanted to work on other meaningful games. So I stayed there and shipped two games while I was there. And then I came to WB, and that's where I've been since.
Now, For Honor is like bloody huge, obviously. And but I think the thing that's really amazing about your experience is that you kind of like me also have like a scattering, right? You've done some huge projects. You've also done some really small projects. You've done some love letter projects. You know, so can you kind of like just kind of like walk us a little bit through your journey? Like what were the big lessons going from thing to thing that you had to like add to your, you know, ways of thinking, your ways of processing the world that changed from project to project that made you capable of becoming who you are now?
Absolutely. Actually, I could start at the beginning. My initial intention coming into the industry was to work in the industry for about a year, learn everything there is to know about making games, and then starting my own studio. Incredibly naive. Within
only one year. That was aggressive.
Yeah, well, I mean, I really had a lot of confidence in my own abilities, but like even for me, that was really ridiculous. And I figured that out two, three weeks later. I'm like, oh my god, that's ridiculous. I'm not going to be able to learn everything I need to know about game making in a year. So I adjusted and I said, you know, whenever it happens, it happens. And it hasn't happened. I haven't started my own studio. That's still something in the old bucket list. But one thing I learned about myself is that I am a generalist. Whenever a project shipped at Gameloft and another project would start off in the same franchise, oftentimes we'd be given the choice. We were fortunate because it was a big studio and there were a lot of projects going at the same time. We'd be given a choice whether to stay on that same franchise and continue and, like, you know, gain deep knowledge in a thing, or if we wanted to jump to a different project and, you know, diversify a little bit our experience. I never stayed. I mean, given the choice, whenever given the choice, the only time I stayed is when I wasn't given the choice. I always took on the other challenge. So I ended up working on a lot of different games and a lot of different genres. And really quickly, I realized that that's what excites me. It's being challenged. I'm not saying this is better or worse. There are different kinds of designers out there. There are those who really want deep knowledge in a thing. They're going to be your AI experts or combat experts or camera experts or whatever. That's what they're going to do for a long time, and they're going to learn everything about that inside and out. That's what makes them get up in the morning and be happy and excited to go through the day. For me, it's trying something new. I want to you to throw me in and say, okay, I've never designed an AI before. Go. And I want to be able to think about, what does that look like? What tools should I use? You know, I want to fail at it a few times before you figure it out and then go through with it. So that's what I learned about myself. And I think when you compare me to other people who've been in the industry a similar number of years, I've been in the industry almost 15 years, 14, 15 years. A lot of people have done very similar games and they're really good at that one thing. And again, no, I'm not saying my thing is better or worse, but that's not me. I've made racing games, I've made card games, I've made combat games, RPGs, hack and slash, VR, airplane games, as I mentioned before, on every platform you could imagine, console, mobile. That's what excites me. I don't know what's next. I never know what's next because everything is a possibility. Chances are I'm going to go and do something that I've never done before because that's what's most interesting to me. And I think one of the things that I try to pass on to my students whenever they ask me about that, they're like, I don't know what I want to do. I tell them that they don't have enough information right at the beginning to make that choice. They need to jump around a little bit until something sticks, until they realize what kind of, in my case, designer, because my students are designers, what kind of designer they are. Maybe they're the ones who like a specific genre and don't want to move away from it. Maybe they like a theme. Maybe it's a size of a studio that excites them. Maybe some of them are meant for five people studios because they want to put a lot more of themselves in the games. Maybe others are meant for huge productions because they want the prestige that comes with it or the experience that comes with it. All is valid, and you just have to like try it out a little bit and see where you fit. What's a good fit for you?
Has there been any consistent thread throughout your work that one thing that you've always sort of latched onto, even throughout all of these different sorts of mediums?
Yes, actually. I'm generally happier whenever the project I work on has some level of storytelling, even if I'm not the one doing storytelling. I'm very character driven. I love having characters who have background stories and have motivations. That's actually represented in the games I play too, not just the games I make. So that's been the thread. The games, the projects that I've been happier with were the ones that had characters with stories and personalities that interacted with each other.
I love that. I think that's the natural thing for a lot of people is that they find a game that they created or they played, you know, as a kid, maybe at 5 or 12, and then decide they're going to make their spin on that, right? And that's everyone's kind of like return dream, at least at first. But because you've had such a diverse set of different games and projects, I want you to pick a game that wasn't a type that you really loved and one lesson that you picked up doing that and how you felt about the process of learning that lesson.
That's a very good question. Okay, so I actually worked on a racing game when I was at Game Loft. It was called Asphalt. It's not that I dislike racing games. It's just that I never saw myself as a racing game player. I'm not a car guy. You know, I'm not the kind of guy that dreams about getting this or that kind of car. And I usually only played racing games with other people because I like competition. I play fighting games, and racing games fit in that category. The game that we made at the time, there was no multiplayer. It was a single player experience, you know, with progression system. And what I learned is that even when it's not my type of game, I could always find something there that I am passionate about. And I am passionate about progression systems. It's I am a system designer more than anything else. I said I was a generalist, and that's true. But if I had to pick one specialty, I'm more of a system designer. And progression systems are systems. And actually, it was my first time working on progression systems. When I was hired at WB initially, I wasn't hired as a lead game designer. I was hired as an economy game designer to work on the progression system of my current game. And that I picked that up on the project that I didn't, and that wasn't really, I won't say, it became dear to my heart because, you know, I found love for it, but it wasn't necessarily the thing I would have expected to be on. That's still the interesting thing is, I still chose to go on Asphalt. I wasn't put on it because it was different and I wanted to experience it. I thought it would be the last time that I worked on a racing game because I'm like, it's not my jam, but I want to do it at least once. And it wasn't. Mm-hmm. I worked on another Asphalt after that when I had the opportunity. So that's really it. Like, even if you're on something that you don't necessarily have a lot of passion for, you could actually find something you love about it. That's for sure.
For the audience members who aren't as familiar with systems as we are, can you explain what a progression system is and maybe some other system types that exist?
Absolutely. Okay, so a progression system, it'll differ from game to game, but it's a persistent system where players carry over the I tried to define it without using the word progression, but I guess it comes back, carry over the progression in the game. So in Asphalt, the way it works is, did you win any races? What rank did you come in? How many, you know, currency, stars, or whatever it is that did that give you? What does that unlock going forward? Do you have to go back and play other things to unlock more so you could move forward? So in different games, progression systems are different things. So for example, in RPGs, oftentimes it's a level up system that unlocks a skill tree that gives you ability points, that unlocks abilities. So for us in Asphalt, it was unlocking the tracks, but also unlocking cars that allow you to, you know, to progress further, like faster cars, and also unlocking upgrades for those cars. So the progression comes that way. It's really persistent data that the player earns in one way or in the other. And it differs from game to game. Not every game has a progression system. Some games, you know, you can tell if the game, if you turn off the game, turn it back on, download it to a different platform without the cloud saves, and the state is always the same, like you always start off at the same state, then chances are you don't have a progression system. As soon as there's something that saves that you need to carry over, then there's usually some kind of progression system.
For example, like Pac-Man, the old arcade games, basically there was no progression. You either threw in a quarter to keep going or you were done. Yeah. I remember one of the first games with a little bit of progression, right, was like Mega Man series, right? Which abilities do you have? And they gave you these cool little passwords or helmet faces you had to toggle on or off to get, you know, certain bit codes to reload the game. And that was crazy to me, right? Because I was like, whoa, they're not saving anything. You just have a code and wait, I can keep playing the game from where it was. I don't have to start all over again.
It was, I remember having that same revelation of what I can actually continue. Because I remember, I don't know if you remember, but there was an era in the NES era where I would not turn off my game if I had to leave. I would keep it on even overnight because otherwise I would lose all the progress. I think it was Legend of Zelda, I think, was the first cartridge game that had some kind of save system. And it had light progression, like you're able to unlock a few items and hearts or something along those lines. So there was a progression system. It was one of the first kind. But the save system was needed for the progression system to work. And in Mega Man's case, the passcode. So those are excellent examples, but there are different kind of systems. That was your second part of the question. What are other kind of systems that you could have? Endless. Like you could have a weather system in a game. Like you could have a crowd system. Like how are crowds handled? You could have like almost anything that kind of feels to you that it happens on its own is a system. There has to be a system behind it that guides it. It gives it rules and it lets it interact oftentimes with other system. I say oftentimes, always with other system. I can't name one game that has only one system. So
systems are basically like different geared wheels. One system on its own doesn't really do anything. How it interlocks and changes things, other parts of the game, right? An XP system changes your level, which then changes your health and your mana and all of these other things. So I really want to keep this kind of a bit more about your personal journey.
Absolutely.
So I would love to hear about like how your own, like, you're kind of like me, right? You're very open-minded. You love to see new opportunities. You're an absolute novelty monger, right? That's me too. Like, what is new and strange and different in every project? Like, if you had to, like, look, break your life up or your career to becoming, you know, a lead at one of the largest, you know, studios in the world, how would you describe, like, this in three chunks of your journey and the mental leap or the mental development you had to grow going from, like, step one to step two to step three?
That's very interesting that you should say that, because actually there was a little bit of stepping forward and stepping back in my career. And there's good reason for it. I won't say I'm exactly happy about it, but that's just how it works out sometimes. I was a lead before I was intermediate. Yes, because when I started at Gameloft, the teams were really, really tiny. And even though I was a junior game designer, I was the only game designer on the team, and I was assigned technical designers, and I was their lead. So, and that's just how it worked out. It wasn't exactly planned or anything like that. It's just like, oh, I was the most senior designer after it was like my second or third project. I didn't get promoted to becoming intermediate at that point. So I found my career repeated that cycle several times, where while I was at Gameloft, the projects were tiny when I first started. We were like 5 people per project, and then they grew to about 20 people. And then when I left, we're about 75 people, which at the time I felt was big. It was the biggest project I've ever been on. There were more designers on that team than there were developers on my first project. And then when I went to GE, it shrunk again. The teams were again about 5 to 10 people. And I was the lead of multiple projects that ran at the same time. I in the 2 years I was at GE, we shipped about a dozen games because they overlapped. I was like designer on one, but lead on the other three, always like juggling those roles. And then when I went to Ubisoft, it was a 500-600 person team. I don't know how big it was. I wasn't a lead anymore. I was at that point, I was a senior designer, and I was assigned juniors to mentor, but I wasn't officially their lead. I wasn't approving their schedules or doing anything like that. So in some ways, that was a big leap for my career, but in other ways, it was kind of a step back. Although I didn't see it that way. Like I think what's interesting is that designers have to be flexible, because we're problem solvers. So we have to kind of adapt to the situation that comes. And I learned that because my career has always been in flux. I go from small projects to big projects, from different projects all the time. So I'm like a Swiss Army knife. Whatever tool you need at the time. Oh, you need a lead? Okay, I'm there. You need me to mentor people? No problem. I got this. You need me to learn this thing and action it because nobody else on the team can do that? No problem. So to break up my career, it's a little bit difficult because some parts kind of fit in together, but there are other parts that kind of seep around them. Mm-hmm. But I would say there were individual contributor is one big category where I was just given a feature or given a role on a project, and I had to do that one thing. And that, funnily enough, wasn't on the first few projects I was on because I was the lead. So I was responsible for the whole project. And then responsible for a whole small project, which is a very different beast than being responsible for a big project. Because generally when you're responsible for a small project, you're still a designer on it. You don't have, there's not enough to pass to everybody else. There's not enough work for that. There's going to be some, there's not enough people to take on that load. It's a small project. And then being on a big project, especially lead on a big project where you don't have time for design anymore. I don't remember the last time I worked in an editor, like, you know, like the actual tools that make the game. Like, I see it, I know what it looks like, I remember working on it before, but who has time for that now? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That's totally, yeah, I love that breakdown. I really like how you separated out the, you know, the skill growth, right, which was your contributor level stuff, your soft skill growth, which was, you know, managing and mentoring. And then lastly, your organizational phase, right? Because the organizational one is about handling people at scale, yes, which is very different from handling people face to face or being in power over them in any degree, which is completely different from craft and skill. And I've really liked to feel like the industry has started to acknowledge that more openly now, right? With, hey, the skills you need to lead a group is not the same as being the guru of a group. is not the same as the person who plans and schedules the entire organization.
And
that just means that, you know, people like you who came in with very great soft skills and good team dynamics have a better chance to be seen and recognized, even if your craft skills aren't the same place. There was a guy actually at Riot. His name is Alex Lemon or Lehman. And I remembered him because he would come in on his motorcycle every day and pull his helmet off and go, ah, it is such a great day to be here. And the reason I bring him up is he was a lead on the animation team. And after, I can't remember if it had been 3 months or 6 months, you know, he was a lead and he had these super talented people. And he came in one day and said, I need to step down. We were all like, what? What? Personable? He's like, I am not good enough at the job here to be leading this group, but I hope to be someday. Therefore, with the permission of the other animators around me, I would like to propose X be a lead, and I will step down and learn from him and the other animators here to develop my skills, so maybe someday I can return as a lead animator. Not only, number one, did he do that, two, it dramatically improved his own career, and he went on to be able to be trusted and handle and lead other projects, because that level of humility above all of that is so rare to find.
I would love to meet this person. That's incredible. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was one of those moments where you're like, wait, but you're giving up the power, but no, he gained everything. Mm-hmm. He gained complete trust in the team. He developed his better skill set, and he gained the time and space to make sure that he was doing what was right for the others.
I know only one other person who's done something similar, who was exceptional as, I'm not going to say the role, but exceptional in their current role, because I don't have permission to talk about the person. So much so that he became a director, and after becoming a director for a while, he said, this is a different skill set. I'm really good at creating the thing. I'm not very good at guiding other people into making the thing. So I would like to go back to not being a director, please. Mm-hmm. And same thing. I thought that was it showed a lot of humility. And it also underlined a problem that we have in our industry, where the lead position is often shown as a reward, as like a progression track, a little somewhere in between, when really it's a different skill set.
I'm always trying to tell that to my parents, because my parents will say, oh, why don't you try to be a lead position where you're in charge of everybody else and you get to tell them what to do and it's your company. And I'm like, no, that's not really what I want, though. I want to make the art. I don't want to tell other people how to make the art. It's not the same thing. It's not like a better version of the same thing. Like you said, it's just two totally separate skill sets. And I could do it probably, but I wouldn't be as happy. So,
and the ultimate goal is your happiness. It's not whatever it is, whatever criteria that other people put before you. To be honest, I'm the first to admit I'm not the best designer on my team. I'm not even maybe third or fourth best. I'm just not. And I don't have to be. Like, I am a generalist. I could speak to all of them. I kind of understand what all of them are doing to a certain point. And I have other skills. Like, I have, the, you know, the as you call them, soft skills that I'm able to get more out of my team. I'm able to understand what their problems are. I'm able to find them solutions, those kind of skills. The best designers, any skill set, let's say the best programmer, isn't necessarily going to be a person who has these same skill sets. So by promoting this person, rewarding them with a lead position, you're doing two things. One is you're making everyone under them unhappy if they don't have that skill set. And the second is you're removing the best programmer that you have on your team, because they're no longer going to be programming. So you're actually hurting yourself in at least two ways, maybe more, because you're likely going to make the programmer unhappy and they're probably going to leave as well, which is not going to help anyone either. Mm-hmm. So, and this is a problem I see everywhere.
Yeah. And this is very different from someone saying, I want to develop these skills, help me build them.
Yes. Very, very different indeed. And even in that situation, the studio, the company has to have a path that person can follow and gain those skills, or at least at the very least, to be able to determine whether they already have them. Before I became a lead at Warner Brothers, that's one of the things I'm eternally grateful for, is they actually gave me leadership training. It's the first time I've been lead in my career many times. It's the first time I ever had leadership training, and it was eye-opening. Mm. It was validating in some ways, because I'm like, oh, I already did a few of these things. And it blew my mind in other ways, where I'm like, wow, I was approaching this completely wrong. Oh, I was a cheerleader manager. That's not very helpful. I should stop cheerleading. That's not something that actually brings value. Let's be a problem solver. Let's have more empathy over here. Like, these are like situational skills that I could apply in different situations, instead of thinking this is a thing that I could apply all the time. So that was invaluable, and I'm incredibly grateful for it. So if you have that as a path that people can take optionally, or at least explore to see if it's a good fit, it's better than just, this is a reward track. You're good at this, you're going to be lead.
Well, tell me a little bit about that cheerleader manager, and an example of how you expressed yourself perhaps in the wrong moment, and then how you would do it now that you've developed these skills.
So one of the things I learned, one of the problems that I had in my managerial style, is that if everything was, I'm eternally optimistic, always. This is my default, right? And I have to fight it. So if something's going bad, I'd be like, don't worry, we got this. But that's not helpful. What if we don't got this? So the more useful approach would be, you know what? You're right. This is tough. Let's hear out some solutions. Oh, this is not as bad as you think. If you have a more measured approach, a more analytical approach to it, and you still show empathy, you become like, you get... You earn the trust of your team. At the end, they understand. Like, if you're always saying that everything is easy, then there's no trust. Like, that breaks down. So you have to have situational leadership. And you have to also understand when to micromanage and when not to micromanage. Because micromanaging is a slur, but it actually doesn't have to be. In some situations, it's actually called for. I had one situation, this is before Warner Brothers, where I learned this on my own, where I had an overachiever as a junior designer that was assigned to me, a minority. She was brilliant. She was so smart. Her first crack at any design doc, she nailed it. You know, well, of course, you have to prototype and test it out. But I'm talking about, like, she thought of everything. I couldn't break down her designs. I'm like, you're going places. So she would show me her designs. I'd look over it quickly. I'm like, great, these are great. Let's go. And I meant it. And after like a little while, we had our first one-on-one after about a month. And I'm like, you're doing great. She's like, I am? Like, I didn't get any feedback. I'm like, what are you talking about? I told you everything was great. She's like, yeah, but I didn't get any feedback. There was no support. I had to actually, I realized that I was treating her, because of her skill level, at the same level as this, like any seniors who were on the project, where I'd be like, you know what? That's good. I trust you. Go. Because of,
and she didn't know what to go, where to go, what was the next step.
She didn't know. So she would like put a lot of pressure on herself, put a lot of time, and she needed a little bit more micromanaging, where I'd be like, okay, this is what you do next, or this is how you action it, instead of trying to figure it out all on her own. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem, is that most people, actually almost everyone, has one default managerial style that they apply in every situation. But that's not helpful. It's going to work in some situations, and it's not going to work in most of the others. So it's a skill to develop all the different, you know, managerial styles that exist, to foster them, to learn from them, and figure out when to apply which. It makes you a better manager in the end, and it makes your team happier.
It seems very similar to being a teacher. I know that as a student, I saw that there were many different teaching styles and many different learning styles. And there would be teachers who were very critical and never said a nice thing about their work. And some people really seem to thrive on that. But I'm like, soft baby. And I'd be like, why are you so mean to me? Tried really hard. And so I always did better with professors who were more positive in their feedback, but at the same time, you don't want to have that toxic positivity that you were talking about, that almost sort of gaslights people and doesn't acknowledge when things are difficult and when they might need more help. So it seems like there are a lot of similarities there. And I'm wondering also about, you mentioned earlier your mentorship and your students, and do you work at a school, or if not, how did you get those students?
So even though technically I'm still a teacher at Dawson College, I don't have a course load right now. But I've been at Dawson College as a professor of game design for I think it's up to 10 years now. 10 or 11, I can't remember. I was actually the coordinator of the video game programs at Dauphin College. I authored the independent game design program and you know pitched it to the Ministry of Education, got it approved, all of that. So I have one foot in academia. I just took a little bit of time off because it's a lot of work. It's very tiring. But you're absolutely right. There's so many... I actually learned how to interview people from teaching. Because in our program, we interview the students as well. And I saw the sheer volume of students that I have to interview. It's literally over 100 each cohort, each semester. So you get better at a thing the more you do it. So I was able to pick up on warning signs. I was able to figure out when somebody's uncomfortable and how to make them more comfortable. So when to ask an open-ended question, when to ask a more directed question, all of that. Which translated and helped me in my current job, where I'm much better at interviewing now than I was when I first started out, where I literally, the first interview I was thrown into several jobs ago, the first time I ever interviewed a person, I Googled, how do you interview a person 5 minutes before the interview? Because I had no training, no idea what I was doing. All my questions were generic. At the end, I had answers. I didn't even know how to assess the quality of the candidate based on those answers. I just had a list of questions to ask. Eventually you pick that up. And I know that wasn't exactly your question, but the two help each other big time. Like, I mean, I don't know if you know this about me, but video games or being a game designer is actually my third career. I studied political science and I worked as a shipping agent. I went on ships, I did their customs paperwork, and I saw to the needs of the captain and the crew. And sometimes it could be as simple as, we're out of vegetables, can you contact this truck, food truck, to come and deliver vegetables? And other times it was, we're bored, can you take us bowling, or whatever it was. So they had a bunch of needs. Some of them were fun, some of them were less fun. I hated the customs paperwork. I loved the rest of the job. But there was a lot of traveling involved, and I moved on from that. And when I decided I didn't want to do that anymore, I didn't have much to fall back on. With political science, like, what can you do? I didn't want to be a politician. That's for sure not a thing I was interested in. I fell back on a thing I taught myself. I taught myself graphic and web design when I was really young. I made a website for my dad when I was 14 years old and for some of his friends. And I'm like, hey, I learned how to do this. Maybe I could just do it freelance. And I did. And I learned Flash and I learned a little bit of scripting, and that helped me create a portfolio. And that's eventually what helped me get into the gaming industry. The soft skills that I learned, a lot of them were from the shipping company, because you're meeting people from all over the world with different sensibilities and different backgrounds. The combination of these two jobs made me into the game designer I am today. Nothing is a waste. I tell a lot of people, I was 28 when I started in games, and I thought I was an old man of games at the time, because especially back then, the average in my studio was like 23. I'm not even kidding. It was super, super skewed, really young. There, my lead was 25, and he had 3 years of experience. And back then, that felt like something I could never reach. 3 years, oh my God, how do you get that many years of experience? And I was, here I am, 3 years younger, and I had zero. So you compare yourself to other people and you feel bad about it. And it's wrong. It's all wrong, because that's not what it's about. I came with experience. I did. I came with life experience. I came with tangible, like, soft skills and even hard skills from my other jobs that I was able to apply directly. In some cases, I was overqualified for what I was doing, because when I was creating mock-ups and fakes, and Alex will tell you that's a big part of game designer's jobs, you create mock-ups and fakes, I was spending too much time in perfecting them. One of my option screen mock-ups shipped with a game I made, because it was so good that nobody knew that it was a mock-up. It was a fake. They cut up the art and they put it in a game. I won't tell you which game. Mm-hmm. Even many years later, I'd rather not mention it. Mostly because I don't want the artist to be like, aha, I knew it. But like, that's what I mean. It's, everybody has their own journey. Everyone has their own path. And comparing each other, ourselves, to other people, it's not helpful. It's really not.
Yeah, it sounds like that experience that you had so much value. And one thing that I found on your website that you listed alongside the biggest accomplishments of your career is advocacy.
Yes.
And I'm sure that your political science education must have had a lot of overlap with that. So can you tell me a little bit about that and your advocacy?
Absolutely. So I'm Muslim. I was born in Iraq. And when I started working in the industry, actually specifically in the company I worked in, Gameloft, I don't believe there was another Muslim. I mean, there might have been one that I wasn't aware of, but I didn't know of any other Muslims. Shortly after, a handful more were hired, but I was the first Muslim that I knew at the company. And I worked with wonderful people. I love them very much. The language of diversity and inclusion back then was completely different. Like, I didn't know the term microaggression. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't something that was that people spoke about. As a result, I actually was, faced with a whole bunch of microaggressions. This is just, that was par for the course back then. To a certain degree, I was used to it because I worked in the shipping industry. In the shipping industry, it's like, forget it. It's like people from all over the world, no one's careful about what they're saying, and you have to develop a really thick skin. And another part is I really wanted to belong. I really wanted this to be my industry. And it hurt. It was grating, especially from people who I loved and respected and who I knew didn't mean anything bad from it. This is just, they didn't know any better. But when you're a junior, you keep your head down and you don't say anything. You don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to say anything. So the first few years, I'd laugh along. People would say things like, oh, you're a closet terrorist. And I'd be like, ha, 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 that's really funny. Thank you for saying that. And or people would say something like, you're one of the good Muslims. I'm like, okay, you're making it sound like that's a rare thing. Thank you, I guess. Like those were common. Those are common. Yeah. They happen all the time. And I just took it, except for my closest friends who would be like, oh, I'm not really comfortable when you say that. For most other people, I'd laugh along. At one point when I had enough experience that I felt a little bit more confident to speak up, I worked on a game, a first person shooter that really misrepresented Muslims. And the straw that broke the camel's back was that there was a level that there was a gunfight inside a mosque. And I'm like the way it was treated was really disrespectful in a holy, holy site. And that I put my foot down for the first time in my career. I said, no, can we just make this into a palace? Just make it into something else. I'm not going to try to fix everything wrong with this game. But this is this is a thing that I'm putting my foot down. And to my surprise, they were like, oh, okay, we'll change it. I'm like, oh, okay. So now that you're open to hearing about this, how about we also change this? And there were some yeses and there were some no's, and most of the no's were because of production considerations. So I'm like, I should have spoke sooner. So I started speaking sooner. And I realized that, and I mean, I knew this, I really did, but I realized it really, that nobody wants to misrepresent people in a bad way. Nobody wants to do the bad thing. It was ignorance. And that's when I started doing presentations at work and speaking up about it. And I actually prepared a presentation that was called The How-To Guide for Muslim Representation. And I started shopping it around at conferences. It took a while before a conference actually accepted. And I understand. They don't know. No one knew who I was. No one knew what I was going to say. There's a little bit of fear of, let's not rock the boat. But I was given my first chance by another marginalized group. There's a group called Dames Making Games in Toronto. And they're like, yeah, sure, come. Tell us about how not to represent Muslims badly. And they gave me my first public appearance. And that opened up the doors everywhere because they recorded it. It was present. I could actually point to it and say, see, I've given the talk. You could watch it. See, I'm not saying anything bad or scary or risky. And they'd watch it. And every conference made it easier for other conferences to invite me. And eventually I started going all over the world. Literally the last place I spoke before the pandemic hit, I haven't spoken at a conference physically since, was in Australia, the other side of the world. Wow. Relative to me. Yeah. So that's actually my advocacy story. It started really with me being a junior in the industry, being scared, not wanting to talk, and then slowly, slowly building up the courage and the confidence and the experience to be able to do so. And I've had support throughout. Like I always put the disclaimer that I don't want to make it sound like my coworkers from my first job were bad people. They're not. This is ignorance. And the way you fight ignorance is with knowledge. Like you explain it. That's it. There was no ill intent. And the proof is once I started speaking up, change happened, and change happened quickly.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for people to understand, right? Is a lot of the times these things when they emerge. And this is not just, you know, misrepresentation, but things like, why didn't you speak about this issue sooner on almost anything? Is because most of the time, it's not until someone has reached a certain level of power and stability in their position and within the ecosystem of their industry that they then have the clout, the patience, the trust, and the safety, the psychological safety to take those risks, right? In your first year of any job, right, it's almost your job is just to understand where you are and what and try to get one or two things done, right? And it's only around like year three, as you mentioned, that you feel like, hey, or maybe I've kind of got some people who have my back. And then as you hit like five and then 10, right, this you hit a point where you're like, oh, I know what I'm doing. I don't know everything about what I'm doing. So that's the stage, right? It's like, I'm scared, right? I'm terrified. Oh, I think I know shit. Oh, I don't know shit. Okay, I know what shit I don't know, and I do know and I don't know. Likewise, same way emotionally, right? You go from, I'm not sure if I should speak up, to a couple people will hear me out if I tell them privately. Hey, I can put my foot down on a couple things. Okay, I can now speak out consistently and know that people understand that I have the best interest of the team, myself, and the audience.
That's so beautifully put, Alex. Absolutely. That's, wow. You have a knack for summing things up, by the way.
He's very skilled at that.
It really is.
I have to ask you, did you feel at this company that you were at, like you were safe to talk to HR? Was there an HR team at the time?
There was an HR team. I didn't feel any more safe to talk to them than I did anyone else, to be quite honest. For the same reasons I didn't talk to anyone else. I felt I was disposable. I was replaceable, right? If HR heard me complain about a thing, what are they going to do? They're going to go talk to the team. They're going to know it's me. Who else is on the team is going to be complaining about how brown people or how Muslims are misrepresented in the game? So it's just a long way to get to the same point. I didn't feel any more safe to talk to them. And to be honest, you go to HR to handle things covertly. HR is not going to win these battles for you. So it's not actually going to change the game. You go to HR to get people in trouble. I know that's not really accurate, but that's what it felt like at the time. And that's not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to get anyone in trouble. I wanted people to do better. And I didn't feel like going to HR was going to make people better at any point. So it was always direct.
So I've had some encounters with HR, right? Not for the things people might suspect. Ha ha ha, internet. Mm. Actually when I started at Riot, right, one of the things was like, hey, I'm like, hey, listen, I know from my time at Blizzard, right, like Blizzard was my first professional industry job. You know, I basically got by kicking over cans and seeing what was underneath, right, and being young and loud and inexperienced, people didn't mind that I was the person doing that. You don't mind when the young kid's being the mad scientist. But when I came into Riot, all of a sudden I understood, and after interacting with people for just a few weeks, I'm like, oh shit, these people are looking up to me. They see me as a person who developed World of Warcraft and has all this experience. And I'm like, hey, I don't know how to engage in this ecosystem. I can't be mad scientist except in this very tight group, because otherwise people think that's the best way to do everything. We know that's just a one feature of how I handle things. So they actually assigned me a person in HR to help me kind of like navigate those sort of situations, work through things. And I think that was a really important moment for me. The guy's name was Jerry Prochaska, for those following the industry. He just opened a studio in La Cruz's, New Mexico. So hello, Jerry, when he sees this in Nepali. The thing that was different there was, instead of being like, hey, you are here to talk to Jerry because you're in trouble or to just get training from Jerry, it was like, hey, he was there to be another person in the room to then give feedback and input and direction, so that if I had struggles with someone, there was one time I had a struggle with a particular team member and it was like, I don't hate this person, but we're not communicating. Jerry came along and listened and heard things out. And he was like, oh, this is what's going on. And I'm going to tell a story real quick. I know this is your show.
This is your show too. We can share.
He was like, okay, Alex, I've interacted with you so much. I know you know what you're talking about. And I also know you're really opinionated. So I thought like it was just ego stuff. And I was like, we're going to work on that. But actually, after listening to you and X, I'm not going to say their name just out of courtesy, interact for like 20, 30 minutes, I understand why people get irritated at you, even though you're not attacking their space or you often are working towards the same goals. And he described it like this. He's like, okay, Alex, let's imagine we're sitting here at a table and there's a box of donuts. Normal, if you asked me, Jerry, hey, would you hand me a donut? And I'd be like, what kind do you want? or I would just grab the box and like, take your pick, right? It's donuts. I don't care which one you want, right? But when someone comes to you, Alex, and they ask you, hey, can I have a donut? You stop and ask, oh, what do you want? And they'll be like, coconut. You'll be like, oh, why do you want coconut instead of peanut? Have you thought about maybe trying almond instead, right? And once in a while, that could be okay if there's a good reason for it. But you do it every single time. You want to make very sure that what they're asking for is what they actually want. They just want a fucking donut because they want a sugar hit. And not understanding and acknowledging that means that everyone is paying the Alex conversation tax in order to get a very small thing that they need instead of just you just doing the easy thing, handing it to them and moving. Now, you have to reapply this to a development sense, but that little thing adds up where eventually people were just like, I don't want to deal with this. Right. Or they would go to someone else to give their feedback and have them relay it. And that person who loved to debate would talk with me and we'd debate, figure everything out. Like, okay, it's a peanut donut. We just bring a box of peanut donuts. The team, we not know which who it was.
So I have a question for you, Alex. How did you take that feedback?
It was like a light went on in my head because prior to this, I've been like, I'm doing the right thing. I'm digging into the issues. I'm making sure we get the right results. My implementation, my tech implementation sure is a little sloppy, but that's why programmers redo things. What is going on? Why are people irritated with me when we got to a great result for the players and for us internally? And it was because it was just exhausting to act with. And when that light went on, I was like, oh, this is fixable. Yep. It isn't that I was in the right and these people were oversensitive. It wasn't that I was deeply in the wrong and I was brutalizing people. It was just sometimes just give them what they want and then let the mistakes sort themselves out later. Actually, if they're and another guy, this guy named Darren, who's a mentor to me later, said, Alex, I want you to ask yourself, what will happen if I let this go? The answer is it'll be a small thing and we'll make a tweak down the road and fix it then. Let people make their mistakes.
That's beautifully put. This is the thing to take away from that, in my opinion. We all have those personality quirks, every single one of us. And a lot of times what we consider compatibility on a team is when another person's quirks don't bother you. And that's all it is. It doesn't mean that there's a person who's perfect. That doesn't exist. I actually shared my problem was I was a cheerleader and that's not a good thing. And I still fight that. I still have the urge. Every time someone tells me everything, oh, this is not working out, I still want to say, don't worry, we got this. I'd have to stop and say, why isn't it working out? Let's fix it. And that's a problem. The candor that you're discussing, where someone can actually sit you down, tell you what the problem is, that's what's going to fix it, nothing else. And the other way around, how you take that feedback, it doesn't mean that now that you're aware of it, you're going to be able to fix it on the spot. But it just means that if you don't let it get to you and you know, take the time to work on it, it's fixable. And I'm really not going to give any details about which project for this, just in case you find out who it is. But one of the art people, I'm not even going to talk about the role, that I had to work with in the past, had a reputation for being very difficult to work with before I got caught onto the project. And I didn't know what to expect, but when I started working with him, I didn't notice that at all. A little bit. Every time I asked for a thing, I would be asked why. And if I had a reason why, there would be no problems. And I realized that that's all this person wanted to know, is that you put some thought behind it. If you didn't put some thought behind it, they wanted to do their own thing. And that's it. And that's it. They just were like, well, if you're just giving me random things, I'm going to do my own thing. I'm the art person. So if you don't give me a game design reason for what you're asking, then that means I don't have to listen to you. And that made that person seem extremely difficult to work with for other designers who might not have had the time to explain the design reason or might not have thought that they had to. So it'd be like, because I said so, because the doc said so, because that's the vision, because that's the design. And he would go on and do a different thing. So the way to fix that is to speak to the person and tell them, are you aware that you're doing this? Are you aware? And whether they answer yes or no is to be like, this is a problem that has to be addressed. But also the person who's dealing with that person can approach in a more sensitive way and be like, okay, this is a thing that person does. Maybe I could approach it differently. It's a back and forth. It's like any other kind of relationship, right? So it's incredible that you came to that conclusion as well. And it made you a much better developer.
actually, that's the thing, right? It wasn't my conclusion. It was someone else being present and being able to provide the light on it. But then I could be like, oh, this is what I do. Here is why I do it. And here is how to get better, right? And then the end result, the what, was being a better developer and easier to work with. I can still be a pain in the ass. I'm very opinionated, but I just always look back at Jerry in that moment at conference room as a turning point in my growth as a person. And I think that that is kind of one of the things that's a struggle in the industry, right? Because we have problems, right? And we're always going to have problems. Humans come bundled with problems. And we need to have safety valve mechanisms to abort really bad problems, right? They need to exist over research and examination and then poof, right, eject. Mm-hmm. But we also need another path, which is, okay, how do we develop and improve situations where growth is possible, the people involved don't want the state of affairs to keep going, and have an accessible, reachable group that you can reach out to be like, hey, having this struggle, and you bring it early enough before the relationships are damaged. Because there's this beautiful book, I think it's Crucial Confrontations, and it says there are three layers, right? There's the incident that happens, there's the pattern, right? The sequence that happens. And then only after both an event has occurred and events have repeatedly occurred, then does the relationship get eroded, as the pattern doesn't change happening. And if you understand that and you know how to address each of those different moments, you know, a great example, when Ari and I were starting working this podcast, there was a moment where after the podcast, Ari was like, Alex, you step on my talk when I'm speaking too often, right? And I'm like, yeah, I do. I don't mean to. I'm just excited and jumping in. And we had to figure out, okay, well, then after a couple episodes, like, well, this is still happening. How do we work on this, right? And we didn't get to the point where the relationship was damaged as we acknowledged the incidents and working on them. I think it's a little bit better now, but I don't know. Maybe you've some.
No, certainly. That is one thing I admire about you, Alex, is your ability to take feedback, even when it's somewhat critical, not get offended, but really take it for what it's meant for. And there's something that I've seen going around that says when somebody establishes a boundary with you, it's not because they're trying to push you away. It's because they want to keep you close. And I think the same thing applies within professional relationships as well. If you give somebody feedback about how they can have a better relationship with you, it's not because they want to shame you or make you feel bad. It's because they're trying to preserve and grow the relationship. So thank you for being the way that you are. And I wish that more people would be like that.
I'm just really happy to be here to witness this exchange. This is beautiful.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. I actually want to like close that little triangle with saying the thing I admire about you, Osama, is you create is contexts, right? You create the opportunity and scenarios where people feel safe enough to do that, right? Maybe not instantly, but over time. And that is just so incredibly valuable. And so it's one of those hidden skills of the industry, right? Everyone sees the flashy names, the Sid Meier logos, right? You don't see the little moments that lead to teams being really cohesive. And I've worked with enough toxic teams that are usually about one situation where like some person who's a great individual contributor continue to be thrust into power, is incredibly inept and refuses to acknowledge the ineptness. The team hits a point where they no longer want to acknowledge or even work with the person to point out their flaws. They just start quitting and they're like, oh yeah, random. They make excuses because they don't even on the way out think it's worth the time to give the feedback. Be like, hey, you have made this an awful environment by being critical and not carrying leadership and respect to the rest of the whole ecosystem
here. Absolutely.
And that sucks. And you see amazing teams fall apart. That happens. And you're a person who proactively prevents that from happening, or at least the best.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for saying so. I'd say actually I even noticed a trend where even people who are not like aggressive or unkind, just by not taking feedback is enough to erode that relationship. I've worked with people in the past in other studios where they say, my door's always open, you could come talk to me. And then when you go to talk to them, they spend all their time and energy to tell you why you're wrong and why they're right. They're kind, they're not yelling, no one's throwing chairs, but they're not listening and they're not making that change. And that's toxic in and of itself. It's a different flavor of toxicity, but it's still toxic. And what's going to happen is that people will stop going to them. Mm-hmm. Maybe even more so than the person who is aggressive, because at least maybe they're listening.
I did that year three at Blizzard, straight up. I look back and I'm like, I absolutely did that. I fought everything because I thought the debate was going to lead to the insights. Sometimes there's a couple people who want to do that, but they're rare and you discover them over time. Usually the best thing to do when someone brings you feedback, create a context where everything they're saying is right. Not yes man them, but then just be willing to imagine in your head a world where every feedback point as they experienced it is completely true. How did that experience go? How did they feel? How did they act? How would you change the experience, make that better? And then once you've thought about that entire possibility space, then you step back and say, okay, what are the other contexts I contain and how do I resolve those?
I think the two of you take perhaps a slightly more optimistic view of humanity and people than I do. But I think, Osama, that you're really fortunate that team that you worked on when you brought up your concerns at last really did want to listen to you about it. I've been in circumstances, both professional and personal, where I've brought up similar concerns where not only were they dismissed, but it really backfired and caused a lot of erosion in the relationship. So
I'm so sorry.
It happens. It's yes. Okay. I mean, it's not okay, yeah. But like, I'm okay.
Yeah.
But it sucks that it happens. And I can only imagine if I was in your position, how nervous I would be to risk your position and your relationships with your team members. That must have been scary, even when you got to the confidence that you were ready to do it.
Absolutely was terrifying. And it could have gone the other way. And that was the point where I was prepared for it to go the other way. I had my CV ready in case it got extremely bad, or I was able to, I was willing to ask to be switched to a different project or something like that if it got, you know, medium bad. I thought about all the different repercussions. So my heart goes out to you because even though it did work out for me, in my mind, it didn't in many different ways. So I know, I know how at least I've role played it. And I've spoken to a lot of people since then in the years who it went really bad for them as well. And that's not easy. That's actually why I give the advice that if you, if there's an injustice on your team, if there's something wrong, speak to your direct manager or supervisor only and see how, let them deal with it. And if they're not willing to deal with it, don't do anything. Because there's a power dynamic in play. You can't do anything. And if that means that you have to find a different job, if you're not comfortable, so be it. If you're not able to and it means you have to hunker down and just like, you know, tough it out, you know, that's not the best situation. But don't go over their heads. Don't fight it. It's not going to end. Like 9 times out of 10, it's not going to end well for you. The power dynamic is against you. Bide your time. Come back and fight when the time is right. I've seen it go bad more often than good. I was just really fortunate.
I have a thing to throw in there that I think is important as well. There's a mental model I like to introduce when thinking about these situations, which is power to move another person is limited by the strength of the cord that connects you, right? That means that when someone just meets, right, you're gonna have like maybe a bare thread. You can't really get people like, hey, maybe you want to grab ice cream. Oh no. Snap, right? But over time, and only when you've established that you have their goals, interests, and a shared set of values in mind, does that thread grow into a rope or a cord or a chain, at which point then you can take immense, you know, leaps of faith and like request from other people. If you try to pull harder on the connection than it exists, it will always snap because the connection is not there. And I've seen some people, I'm not saying you are specifically, but I've seen some people who go into that situation, they have the right values, but they don't have the right degree of connection and trust established. It fails. And then they see, oh, I can't do this, as opposed to, no, this just wasn't the relationship that was strong enough to handle this. Mm-hmm.
It's just it's difficult really because when you have that model, but then when you add in the layers of people with privilege and people with various backgrounds. And if you imagine the two people and the connection, but then one of the people slaps the other person casually all the time. And like, maybe they don't even realize that they're doing it or stepping on their feet. Maybe that's a better sure. analogy.
Straight up actual stepping on their feet. All right.
And so you're trying to build up this relationship, but then all the while your toes keep getting stepped on and it feels unfair to have to wait to say, hey, man, you're stepping on my toes. So yeah.
And it is unfair, but sadly, power dynamics are unfair more often than not. Like, it's, if you're telling, sometimes you just have to test the waters. You have to see how they react if you say it one time. And if they react really violently and bad, then you know how they're going to react another time. And you're going to have to choose your battles if it's going to be worth, are your toes the hill you're willing to die on?
Yeah.
And maybe they are, and maybe they're not. And that's not for us to judge here. Every situation is completely different. But you have to, everyone involved has to keep in mind the power dynamics. Like, giving one set of advice for everybody, a blanket statement of do this, is not helpful. It's really going to yield different results depending on the context. And even the person in the situation is not going to be, like, with way more information than you, is not going to know how it's going to pan out. So how are you going to give the advice and know what's going to happen? So you just have to test the waters, see what, you know, push things to a certain limit, and then see what you're able to get away with. And hopefully it'll work out for more and more people. And now that this conversation about microaggressions and about, you know, diversity and inclusion and like power dynamics in general, even for people who are from the same walks of life, it's becoming more mainstream. At least there's this, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Level playing field, where people are actually, or a common language. There's like a common language that people can use is the term I was looking for. Yeah.
Yeah, that conversation is much more front stage center. Yes. So people are more comfortable having it. I think you're totally right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But literally look at this guy here, right? Literally has transformed like entire projects through the fact that he found
you're giving me way too much credit. Thank you. You're being very, very kind.
Okay, fine. You made some good comments. Now,
that I'll take. Thank you.
Well, yes, Osama, thank you so much for coming on our show. Thank you for your advice and the advocacy that you have done throughout your career and all the projects that you've done. It was really such a pleasure talking to you.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm super happy to be on.
And before we go, Osama, I just want to say thank you so much for coming here. I feel I've said so much about, you know, I admire what you've done and what you continue to do. And honestly, the best thing I can say is just thank you for having gone through these painful periods and growth for those of us who now are benefiting from it, right? Because that's really the end of the day. The next generation of game developers is going to have a better ecosystem because you existed where you were.
Because we existed, right? We're in this together and we're all making it better. Thank you all. Can I do finger hearts?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, let's do it. And this goes to everyone in the audience. Right? Absolutely. You're all part of fixing this.
We love you all and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye.